Again, everybody, John Porteous of the Lovells Township Historical Society here, and you're listening to the Backcast Podcast. Welcome back. We've got a good one for you today. Mitch Selhaney and Don Boyd are joining us from the Grayling Hatchery. We have some breaking news, so we decided to bring this episode to you a little faster than originally anticipated. So, very educational, very informative, and very fun. I think you guys will like this one. So, without further ado, here we go.
Hey, everybody. John Porteous and Richard Perry here. We're joined by Don Boyd and Mitch Selhaney of the Grayling Hatchery. And as promised, I think we've got some entertaining discussions to have. So, gentlemen, welcome. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Excellent.
Great. Fun to finally be on the Backcast.
There we go.
Yeah.
Wonderful to have you. Typically, what we'll have you do, guys, is just tell us a little bit about yourselves, how you got involved with the hatchery, how you got involved with fishing, and we'll just kind of drill down from there. Don, you want to start?
Well, I got involved with fishing when I was maybe 6 or 7 years old, and bluegills schooled up under the boat at Corner Lake in the Upper Peninsula, and told my mother I wanted to go fishing, and I've been wanting to ever since. So I've been fishing for 65 years.
That's the way to make it happen.
That's the nature, yeah. Came to the Ausable 1986. We bought some property and on the mainstream and built in 87, 88. And my wife and the kids spent summers up here and eventually moved the my office up here about 6-7 years ago, and we've been full-time for 7 or 8 years.
That's awesome.
Yep.
That's awesome. And I know you're no stranger to cold water conservation projects around the area, so
I am not. I was on the West Michigan Board of TU for about 10 years, and the anglers of the Ausable Board for almost 30 years.
Yeah. So. Good. Mitch, what about you?
Yeah, so...
Kind of new to the program.
Yeah. You know, I guess kind of new to life, too, sitting next to Don over here. But
we all start somewhere.
You know,
I think that's a compliment.
Yeah. It's meant in only the finest.
Congratulations, you're still here.
You know, exactly. It's great that we're so close so quickly. So, yeah, a little bit newer to fly fishing. I've only been fly fishing up here for the past 5 years.
Okay.
Graduated from my undergrad in 2021 with a political science degree. A few years before that, had a fly rod put in my hand and was kind of eye-opening. Coming up here to Grayling and the greater Grayling area really opened up my eyes to a lot of what I thought I was missing in my life.
Excellent.
Graduated with a political science degree and knew that I wanted to move up north immediately after my undergraduate stuff finished up. In and out of Gates Lodge, begging and pleading with Greenberg over there. I told him I'd sweep all the sand out of the river. I'd fold beds, clean the toilets at the lodge. I would really do anything to be up here. He asked me what my degree was in, and I said political science, and he said, well, it's probably just enough science for the fish hatchery.
There you go.
And so a year and a half later, here we are, and enjoying every minute of not only living up north, but working for the fish hatchery and the Grayling Fish Hatchery, and the really a great conservation project that's been going on over there. So,
well, and you know, we've had the benefit of having Joe on before, and we've talked a little bit about the hatchery. We've had Kristen on from TU talking about the bypass. So maybe, Don, you could tell us a little bit, maybe take it up from...
I could. I'll give you a short history.
Yeah.
The hatchery actually began in 1914. It was the idea of Rasmus Hansen himself. He got the property on a timber deal, acquired the property, and around that time decided they wanted to actually attempt to save the Grayling. It was at the same time the Grayling were disappearing. So his wife Marguerite was actually one of the treasurer of the group. He was president, and they actually sold stock certificates to raise money to put in the initial raceways, which were made of wood. It was
wow.
They accomplished it. They got started, And they raised fish, and they were never successful, of course, in preserving the grayling, but they raised a variety of fish. The records there are pretty scant as to the numbers and quantity, but they raised fish until about 1926, when the state bought it over and turned it into a production facility for stocking statewide. And they did that from around 1926 until the mid to early 60s. My dates are not exact, but within a year.
Okay.
So they ran that until about the mid-60s. The state stopped because of the inefficiency. As you know, it's a flow-through facility, which means the East Branch feeds the hatchery. And so they put up with temperature fluctuations, water clarity fluctuations, and all the evils that go, and of course the virtues that go with a trout stream. So the state wanted to make their rearing facility more efficient. They went to more captured systems, groundwater, well water systems. And then they ran it until the county took it. They finally ceased operation. About 1979, the county wanted the hatchery back as a tourist facility, which it had always been. It attracted a lot of numbers. At one point they said it attracted 40,000 people in a year. I doubt that number, but that was actually at least reported in the history. The county ran it off and on until they could no longer float the expense of keeping it open, at which time brings us to the recent history in which it was turned into a commercial trout growing operation. It was a feed and grow operation. I should say a feed, grow, and sell operation. And to make a long story short, local conservation groups, especially the anglers of the Asabel, Mason Griffith Trout Unlimited, became very concerned about the impact of the effluent, nitrogen, phosphorus, ammonium, and some other effects, biological,
the scale of a production
oxygen
facility.
Death. Yeah. So after a number of legal machinations over about 2.5-3 years, the anglers bought the grower out. He was wanting to grow hundreds of thousands of pounds of fish a year in those raceways. We've reduced it to 1,000 to 1,500 pounds a year, showing that we've reduced the magnitude on the order of 100 times, if not more. So we have a safe system now, and our mission is to continue it as a trout park, so to speak, with the major mission of recreation for tourists, research, hopefully, and a planting program. We plant the fish in House Lake. So that brings us up to date, and we're run by a totally volunteer board, which is a working board, which means we sweep raceways and build screens and repair and take care of things, and Mitch heads that up.
We're completely familiar with a working board.
There you go.
For the last 2 years, we've operated at a maximum of 1,200 individual fish, and whether you know the state gives us 1,200 pounds of fish or 1,200 individuals of fish, it has stayed the same for the last 2 years for that very reason of minimizing our effects on what's flowing back out into the East Branch, which eventually, you know, 140, 50 something miles down the road flows out into Lake Huron.
Sure.
So the state provides fish, or
yep.
Do you have to buy them, or are they?
Yep. So the state donates. Or? So the okay. Odin State Fish Hatchery donates our fish every year.
Okay. You program out
yep.
800 fish, and then they replace 800 fish. Something like that?
Mainly at the beginning of May, we receive 1,200 fish. We grow them, we feed them, we house them. We're the mamas and papas for these fish until the end of the year. About somewhere in October, November, when the weather's right, we will then move those fish to the site that the DNR has allowed us to put those fish into, Lake Marguerite.
So you go to a zero population?
Yep, zero population. Winter. Completely shut down over the winter, and then the state turns right back around and brings another 1,200 fish at the beginning of May. This year is going to be a little bit different. Kind of have some
exciting things this
year. Yeah, we've got some really exciting things going on this year, especially, I guess that can bring us into our next kind of announcement is we've been we've received 50 individual grayling last week. Wanted to make sure that they were nice and healthy before we came and onto the podcast and talked some backcast. But yeah, so we've received 50 grayling this year. We're going to house those fish permanently through the year. So, yeah, when the rainbow trout are ready to go into House Lake based on the weather in the fall, we'll move, hopefully that number is still close to 1200 fish, that will go into House Lake. House Lake is a great opportunity for recreation anglers to, utilize and harvest these rainbows that we're growing. It's okay. A great ice fishing lake, great access. There's a really nice holdover of fish in there too. So they do make it through the summer. But yeah, so these grayling are alive and healthy and swimming around in one specific raceway at the hatchery, and those are going to be permanent residents throughout the whole year. So
they're going to be year-round?
Yep, year-round through the winter.
In a dedicated raceway?
Yep, dedicated raceway. It's the same system that our rainbows are held in as well. So,
okay, so we don't have to worry about predation within the raceways?
Yeah, and so actually we also were really fortunate enough this past spring to receive two trout hotels from Anglers of the Asable. And so those are added protection barriers added into those raceways. And you can think of those trout hotels as the same ones that you see on the Holy Waters.
You're just putting some woody debris inside the raceway.
Yep, it's a frame. It's a square frame, and it's got basically a roof over the top of it. So you can't see what's on the underside of that trout hotel, and it's just going to provide the next level of protection for those grayling. So they're screened in at both ends where we get our water. Water goes out. But those fish are kind of stuck in there. And then there's also a layer of protective netting over the raceway from some of our aerial friends.
No avian visitors.
Yep, and that's something that we've been dealing with quite a lot.
Oh,
and
really?
Learning about. Yeah, the osprey, it's not really a problem when we're in their world. And that osprey, you can't just tell them to not eat the fish. I mean, that is just one big sushi bar for that bird.
I was going
to
say, you're just serving up a beautiful smorgasbord.
Exactly.
So what are the long-term goals for these grayling? I mean, is there any end game on this? They want to restock them, or are they going to take them back eventually? Or
long-term goal is,
point, I guess,
is we keep them as display fish as long as we can. Okay. There is no, they're not intended at this time to be part of the grayling program, although just the observational value of these fish is enormous because we've got them in the East Branch, essentially, of the Asable, and we're going to see how they tolerate temperatures. We're going to see what their growth rate is. We're going to see their disease resistance, and we're going to get a chance to observe their behavior as well as their growth rate in there. So how they live and survive. The DNR, when we had a conference call with the DNR, and I asked them how important the fish were, and they said, oh, they're reasonably important. And I said, well, what are their threats to survival? And all they would tell us is they're hardy fish. They really, it's an unknown to a degree what their tolerance will be. The research I've done on these things is that they overwinter under extremely harsh conditions in Alaska.
Don't mean to interrupt, but it begs the question, do these come from the same eggs that Nicole had previously brought down?
Yeah,
or
these
whenever?
Yes, these are Thymallus arcticus. They come from Alaska.
Okay.
Occasionally, apparently, they have high enough temperatures in Alaska, not to mimic what we have here, certainly, but we'll see. I mean, this is what happens to these fish and how they live is going to be, I think...
You guys are going to answer the question for the DNR
in
some ways.
Well, we may help answer it.
So definitely some tangent information there.
The state and the initiative has, as we all know, has been working on this project for a number of years. They really take every step and precaution with studying and researching these fish. I really feel like the only new thing that we're going to be able to help provide with any questions answered is the practicability of keeping fish in a natural setting, almost as natural of a setting as you can.
Well, you guys are actually proven ground truth. I mean,
yeah.
This is what happens when you put them out in the world.
Yeah. You know, our raceways feel every swing of temperature. All the sediment that runs through the screens and the raceways, it's unpreventable, and so it's just going to happen.
Sure.
That sediment is also carrying bugs and detritus and stuff like that that's just sweeping through the raceway. Those fish are going to be fed. Those fish have great levels of protection, and they've got really cold water. That next step for the DNR, they've already been working on with identifying different sections of the river.
Oh, sure.
Everywhere in the state. When it comes time for actually doing something about that, we hope that, or at least in my personal opinion, I hope that the Grayling Fish Hatchery can expand a little bit on what the state may not know already. So,
and are the tribes partners in this as well?
I thought they knew everything.
Pardon?
Are the tribal people partners in this as well?
They're not partners in the Grayling
not
Fish
in the
hatchery,
but I meant in the...
Yes, they are.
Yeah.
That is, of course, a completely different but parallel story.
Okay.
I think these are 2.5-year-old fish. They're 6 inches long, fairly slow growing, like 2.5 inches a year, 2.5, slightly below the growth rate of trout in these rivers. And we're going to see how fast they grow in the hatchery. And our rainbows double in weight in 6 months in the hatchery. So we're going to see how they compare.
Is the expectation that you might see a higher growth rate in a more natural environment?
We could. That's yes. And we need to sample the fish periodically and see how they're responding to food and see what their growth rate is.
These are all hypotheses.
Sure.
That we can come up with ourselves.
No, but this is fun stuff to...
No, at the hatchery.
It's very fun.
And with adding our little bit of knowledge and not, you know, adding our little 2 cents of observations and stuff like that, it might be something that, you know, the state doesn't have an expectation for us, but we can still provide with what we've seen. It was kind of described to us that these fish were held in a smaller environment on really stable, set water temperature, regulated water temperature,
okay,
and oxygenation. Really, this is almost like throwing these fish into the wild, wild west.
Were they in a more dense population?
Yes.
Initially?
Yes.
In a very controlled, steady
yeah,
temperature.
Yeah.
Steady temperatures, and we'll have fluctuations, of course. We'll have temperatures up into midsummer, up into the daytime peaks in the low 70s in all likelihood.
You know,
so that's going to be interesting to observe that, see what happens with that.
Well, you mentioned, you know, the flow through, and naturally mm-hmm. there's all kinds of aquatic insects coming mm-hmm. through. The netting on the top may prevent any sort of spinner action, but
oh, they'll find a way. I had olives and Hendrickson's at flying around the hatchery this morning.
I love it. Well, again, naive question, but you'd mentioned that you feed the fish.
Mm-hmm.
Is that an initial feeding? Are you hoping that they will start to remove themselves from your feedings and undertake more natural diet?
So that's an observation that I've been able to make the last 2 or 3 days of these fish, or relative and specific to the grayling that we've got. And again, we only have 50 individual fish, individual grayling. There is a really super strong group response out of the rainbows when fish pellets are smacked down on the water. but with grayling, for the first 3 or 4 days that we had them, there was no reaction to fish pellets, even though they were being fed on floating fish pellets at the Marquette State Fish Hatchery. That's where those grayling came down from, was Marquette. Now, over the last 2 or 3 days, and I saw it today definitively, not 3 hours ago, just by happen chance, that those grayling were actually eating insects, bugs, something on the surface. And it was multiple fish. And then I I stood there for another 10-15 minutes, and you could see the mid-water column eat on some of those grayling too. Their bodies turned. They were clearly grabbing something.
Okay.
The rainbows too, especially last year, they have an inclination to do what they're supposed to do, and that's eat bugs, whether it's nymphs and other kind of stuff like that. The rainbows do it absolutely, and now I'm starting to see the slight pickup of these grayling getting back into the rhythm of eating. But there was definitely a lag period where they were dropped off. They were shocked and stunned. It's a new environment. It's new water.
Transition.
That was typical with the rainbows last year and this year. Every day the feeding just gets bigger, and or the reaction to food coming into the system gets a little bit bigger and a little bit stronger each time you put food down there. With the grayling initially, there was just none of that. Huh. And now I'm hoping that there's not going to be a need for floating fish pellets anymore because they're identifying what they can't eat that's a natural.
That's pretty cool.
So there's enough biomass or natural stuff moving through there to feed them?
Probably
without
not.
Without a supplement?
It
seems like you'd have to have a lot of bugs for 50.
And the raceways are cleaner than the river.
Yeah.
And so there's probably not enough nutrition from natural food.
Okay.
That'd be great if you could.
And so we still put fish pellets down just in case.
Gotcha.
But that little observation of seeing the rise to naturals was alarming to me because I didn't think...
That clear?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's pretty cool. And to that end, it's... You know, we're talking about the water and the strict control that they came from. And again, random left field question, but did you guys take some of the water out of the river and put it in the truck to go up and pick them up?
Nope.
Or they came down in their own?
The only protection is making sure the temperature is within 3 to 4 degrees.
Okay.
So they're not dumped into wildly different temperature regimen.
Mm-hmm.
So by doing that at the beginning, end of April, beginning of May, you're kind of stable environmentally,
right,
in transporting.
And then in the fall, when we transfer them to Howell's Lake, we wait until the temperatures are also within 3 to 4 degrees.
Okay.
So we don't put them in excessively
cold
or warmer water.
Yeah.
And we've had, I think last year in our transfer in late October, we didn't have a single mortality. We put in probably 800 to 900, 10 to 14 inch rainbows in Howell's Lake, and I don't think we had a single fish die.
That's pretty impressive.
Well, the grayling ought to get you some people coming in to look at them, because I know a lot of guys, when they come back from Alaska, all they talk about is the grayling.
Yeah,
well, we've
and you know,
exactly. It's been advertised, the grayling are coming, grayling are coming. I'm a little concerned about that because people are going to come expecting to see big fish, and all they're going to see is a little pile of logs with two little heads sticking out in front. Right now, they're hiding, and we hope they become a little more visible. But
Jurassic Park area.
It is not a robust display at this moment.
Well,
and you know they're very very light in color, almost a cream tan.
Oh wow!
You know, they are not that slate gray color
darker,
that we're all accustomed to. Yeah, and
right.
Those purples are just,
right,
you know, glimmering and glistering off of that top.
Is that just a function of fish maturity?
I don't know.
We don't know yet. The guys from Marquette,
water that they were in before.
Yeah, great. The Marquette State Fish Hatchery did say that we will see a darkening of color with those fish, but they said don't expect them to return to that slate gray with black dots.
Which
on
you might
body.
See in the wild.
Yeah, which you might see
okay.
in Montana, Alaska. Yeah.
Wow.
But this is, you know, extirpation of these fish is sad when it happens. We've lost a lot of really great native species, whether it's fish, mammals, plants, birds, whatever. To have
bugs.
Grayling back, yak bugs, to have grayling back and grayling for the first time in over 100 years, it feels good. And we're working exceptionally hard to make sure that we give, you know, 100% effort into not losing a fish. And if we do lose a fish, we want to know why. We want Marquette to know why we lost a fish. But it's not like we have to report.
Do their biologists come down for visit and say hi? Or
not yet.
Yeah, no. They
visit the fish.
You know, it's kind of it's a tough world out there, but kind of in our book, they don't know, or they know everything that they know for a reason, and there's not something that we're gonna tell them that might just turn this on its head and
sure.
and make some new Einstein discovery.
Talking about the DNR of the fish.
Everything, maybe. it's a fun, yeah. exciting project yeah. that is great for Crawford County and really exciting for Grayling.
Well, it is truly exciting, and we'll kind of maybe circle back to mm-hmm. your, you know, when you were talking about your mission earlier, and I'm assuming one of those legs is education, and that, you know, at a minimum, you've got an eager audience of, you know, students in the school system that will obviously want to visit. I'm sure the biology yeah. classes will be, mm-hmm. you know, pounding a path to your door.
Education, mm-hmm. recreation, and research.
That's our
mission.
I love it.
Yeah, we're hoping to recruit in the future. We've had students from LSSU as intern assistants until last year, and the anglers of the Osabo has been very generous in their support of that student, and the rest of our income basically is donations. So
that leads us to a really great next. Cornerstone of the hatchery as well, and that's community involvement with a lot of our projects. For the last number of years, we teamed up with the Osabo Institute to really green up the hatchery as well, take out sod and grass and replant it with native Michigan pollinator species of plants.
Nice.
That is planted by the Grayling Middle School with the help of the Osabo Institute. Actually, today we ripped up all the sod. I think it's about 120 feet of grass that came up and was moved out to make way for some of these plants. In terms of being able to walking pedestrian bridges over the raceways for better vantage points, these are all community funded aspects of the hatchery. So we've really taken the nonprofit to heart and want to make sure that we're endorsing clean conservation projects, education and sustainability, and kind of at the cornerstone of our community. We're here to teach classes and teach your kids about fun entomology aspects and why trout are important and why they're a great natural resource that is worth caring about in northern Michigan and worth fighting for.
Absolutely.
And, I can't thank the community enough for all the help and support that they've given us while I've been here for the last 2 years. So.
Well, and you're spot on. I mean, the Historical Society, we're a 501c3 as well, and mm-hmm. it doesn't happen without the community.
Exactly.
And, you know, so community, thank you. Keep going.
Bring more money.
Yeah.
Write those checks.
50-50 split, Batcast podcast, Grayling Fish Hatchery.
Have a fun thing. Well, we spent a bunch of time on the Grayling, and I think rightfully so, mm-hmm. but there's more to the hatchery than Grayling.
Much more.
Yeah.
Maybe a quick thumbnail sketch of what's a visitor experience like at the hatchery?
Yeah, so the Grayling Fish Hatchery is open to the public Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. What you can expect, I'm a little bit biased from a fly fishing perspective. I'd hope that maybe you see some sulfurs or Hendricksons if you're here early enough. Maybe, you know, we have seen some hecks during the day at the hatchery too. But you're gonna see a great conservation project with an in-town nature center feel. So the east branch of the Osabo runs right through the property, as we've already talked about the flow-through system. There's a back half to our property as well, where there's natural and wild fish that might be picking up some leftovers that the rainbows and the grayling didn't want with their food. It's a great opportunity to see some really big fish in the river too as well. You're going to see a lot of things that are really specific to northern Michigan in terms of plants, mammals, and just really other wildlife here as well. So I hope when you come to the hatchery, you learn something. You use your eyes and ears to take in the scenery and kind of the property as a whole. I know when I come into work every morning, I take a look around the property, and I'm so thankful to look at my office as the outside, and just to be outside. So, Don, if you have anything
else. It's a rich source of observation. I mean, you get to watch fish behavior. We have one thing we have that's come in there that actually is more entertaining than sometimes the fish in the raceways are these large fish that come up in this holding water, which is the outflow to the raceways. And we can have 50 to well over 100 fish, 18 to way over 20 inches in the lower river. And there's an interesting backstory to this. In 1989, John Hudson did a telemetry study. He was the first of the telemetry studies, and he was tagging individual fish as part of a doctoral dissertation. To try to make the longest story as short as I can, he tagged a fish about 4.5 miles downstream in the mainstream, and in July, he lost it, and it started going upstream. He couldn't keep up with it. He followed it, and the next day picked up the telemetry signal at the mouth of the East Branch, followed it 1.5 mile up to the hatchery, and the fish had turned from a nocturnal foraging fish to a daytime pellet eater.
Wow.
And so these fish, that tells us that these fish probably smell the pellets in the summer, and they're accustomed to moving upstream and taking advantage of that, and their behavior flips. Most fishermen know that large brown trout are notoriously nocturnal, yeah. And they only forage for large prey. But these pellets are so rich in protein that's where they go. And so we also have upstream bias. I observed Raceway 4, the tube is open to that holding area, open to the East Branch. And 2 years ago, we had a screen, and kept a screen at the head of Raceway 4, and there was 50 one-year-old brown trout. These were about 3.75 to 4.25 inches long. All had made it up through that tube, up through that shallow raceway, and were trying to jump over that screen like miniature Atlantic salmon, which shows you that these migrating fish have a tremendous upstream bias.
No kidding.
So you see that, and it opens your eye. It gives you a chance to see things about trout behavior that I don't think is well recorded scientifically.
Well, this certainly makes the case that visitors are going to need more than one trip to the hatchery.
It sure does.
You're going to need to check this out as the season progresses and see some of these things evolve. That's awesome.
We had a brown trout in there eating pellets that we estimated 3 years ago to be about 30 inches long. This thing was enormous. How it even survived in the river to that age is really remarkable.
Well, that's on the downstream town yep. side. It's a towny fish, not...
That's exactly correct.
Exactly. Yep.
So, I'm not saying anything.
Urban.
Get out of the cork and the super.
Yeah.
And you know, there's in the East Branch right there, there's one of the final impoundments for this area up here, and that's dividing above and below the hatchery. There's a big impoundment right there. Michigan Trout Unlimited has put their money where their mouth is in. Combination with Anglers of the Asable really spearheaded the project to reconnect the East Branch of the Asable as well, which is something that everybody is going to really appreciate in the next couple years. Yeah.
Well, and it's cool. You know, our listeners will have heard Kristen talk about this last year, and now here we are.
It's
getting ready. Pretty exciting.
I know there's. Push for the final funding was just happening for the last couple weeks, and I know that they're right there, and so hopefully that project starts up anywhere from the end of this year into early next spring. The sooner the better, though.
Sure.
And as far away from the spawn so we can get those fish to go back upriver and you know, do their thing up in the East Branch, which is really a gorgeous section of river here. The white building. That's an age-old question for us over at the hatchery.
I didn't know if you wanted to talk about it or not.
We can.
We'd love to talk about it, and it's a huge question mark.
Yeah.
It's actually, the property boundaries are zoned off from the hatchery property. We've toured it, and there's been a lot of talk about turning it into an education. I would love to see some senior or some graduate people in there using the hatchery for research.
Mm-hmm.
That's it's going to take enormous money just to make it habitable inside.
Have, some dorm rooms and some labs and stuff. Yeah, and put exactly. Them in there over the year to.
You know, it'd be great if that stuff. That top half, that top level was research and education for students coming in from various Michigan universities, and then the bottom level could be the Fish Hatchery Museum or even the Grayling Historical Society Museum, whatever, right there.
It's it would be a huge project, money wise.
Yeah, how long? Kind of getting back to the East Branch project.
Yeah.
How long once that's funded and they start using the shovels? How long would you anticipate it take to complete that? Maybe it'd be a season.
No, can't remember what that estimation was. It's not going to take as much time as you think. There's going to be a series of weir crests and sediment relief breaks that are going to be above where that current impoundment is.
So they can phase it down.
Yeah.
V structures.
Yep.
Yes.
Gotcha.
It's been, 20, 30 years with that impoundment right there, collecting sediment. You can't just open up the boards and rush that down the river.
Well, you can.
Not going to go well.
It will. My concern is it will go downstream, even with these upstream facing V structures. It's going to increase the rapids. There won't be a block. The sand is building as we speak.
Can you employ a sand wand? That technology?
Well, that's Mason Griffith is actually looking into that. I researched it to see if we could use it in the raceways.
Mm-hmm.
And the kind of things we can afford are problematic because impellers wear out if you're sucking sand through the, and they have to be replaced. And I've talked to a couple of manufacturers, and they've given me not some real optimistic about how long it would take before you have to have the impeller.
Life cycle is going to be real brief.
It's going to be really brief trying to move sand through an impeller system. Mason Griffiths is checking into one. I don't know the details yet, and I don't know if they'll be available to the hatchery, but they probably will be needed in the East Branch when the bypass is complete.
That, mm-hmm. It would just be a nice way to supplant. Obviously, they're not cheap, and giving them away as door prices, but it's, I know that firms rent them, and that might be an option really ease the logistics.
It could be. The bane of the hatchery management right now is sediment in the hatchery itself.
Yeah.
When the water goes up, it recruits sand, and it comes into the head race, and sooner or later works itself right into the raceways. We do a pretty constant battle with sediment.
And folks, if you don't believe us or think that us talking about sand is just a crazy thing to be concerned about, please come to the Fish Hatchery and help me sweep out some of these raceways because getting the hatchery prepped and ready for fish this year, we saw a big uptick from last year of the sediment that was moving through the system. We've still got the heads of two raceways right now are buried in about a foot or two of just sand, sediment. Real tough sediment. You can't do anything other than get in there and just try to shovel it down. So
you dry out that raceway and then
we can when there's no fish in there. Usually we like to have a little bit more running water so that way when we kick up that sediment, it's just going to be transported down with the water flow. So
well, and to that end, within the season, and again, this is my naivete, but do you keep a raceway clean? Do you switch them up and clean them out during the course of a season, or is it all prep and
so
after season?
So about once, sometimes maybe twice a week, we'll remove the top netting, and then myself and then the intern assistant will get in there and sweep down all that sediment. A couple things we have to be really careful about is stress to fish. So we try not to do it when the water temps are really above 60, 65, which is tough sometimes. The other one, too, is blowing out our screens that keep these fish within the raceway. So we have to thread a really thin line of what we're pushing down and how much of it is going down at once, because you can blow out those screens. Once or twice a week we're in there, and yeah, we just have to move that sediment. It's really tough when fish poop and all sorts of other stuff accumulates at the bottom. Exactly. There's 800 fish and they're all eating and going in one place. So we have to move it. You're going to be able to see the fish a lot better.
I don't want
to
see your waders.
Keep those at the hatchery.
They're a different color, baby.
So Don, it begs the question, just as a function of operation, are metrics being assembled downstream relative to temperature and sediment acclimation and that sort of thing?
Yeah, there's conductivity and temperature and flow in a monitoring system downstream. When the fish farm was there, I waited for the hottest day in July, late afternoon, took the temperature above in the East Branch, above the hatchery, then drove down behind the hospital and took it in the East Branch below the hatchery with a handheld thermometer. And I could not record. There may be a one temperature difference. And at that time, I could not record a temperature rise that would have been caused by it. It surprised me, because I thought that was during the time when the legal issues were brewing. And I wanted to see if there was a temperature rise because of warming in the raceways. And apparently there wasn't to the extent I could record it on a handheld thermometer.
Not statistically meaningful.
So yeah, there actually is a few spring inflows coming in through the concrete walls in and around there. There's actually spring influence.
Okay.
I don't know if it's significant, but it may mitigate temperature rises in the summer. And the water makes it through the hatchery fairly quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's. By the time it hits the head race and flows through a hatchery, it's flowing at a rate of 6 to 10 inches a second in some areas, which is slightly slower than the average in the Holy Water, for example. But it's fast enough to clear 200-300 foot of raceway fairly quickly.
We try to have about 3.5 times turnover of the water in that raceway an hour.
I think a lot faster than that.
Yeah.
It clears. So temperature may not be as big an issue as phosphorus, nitrogen, and ammonia mm-hmm. products and those issues downstream.
Here's the other thing, too, is we also employ a quiescent zone. So that was something that we picked up on using, and that's at the bottom of one of our raceways for a settlement zone of whatever is flowing through there as well.
I got to ask, is that like a sand trap?
It's not a sand trap entirely. It's instead of using a full raceway for fish, we use 3/4 of the raceway. It's a screen at the end of that 3/4, and then that last quarter is just collecting all of the nutrients and everything that's going to flow through that could be harmful collects and settles in our quiescent zone.
Okay.
And then that also goes to reinforce our commitment to upholding better practices than in years past.
That's awesome, guys. Yeah.
We do have a sediment raceway, actually, in which we put a large 2x12 on the bottom, and then we set the bottom boards about this far off the bottom, so sand would naturally flow into that raceway. We opened the board, and so raceway 5 is a pass-through for sand right now.
Okay.
That helps keep it, it's not keeping it out of the other raceways, but it helps a little. So there's all these little physical clamp maneuvers that we just problem solve as we go.
Okay.
None of us are biologists.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're learning on the fly.
You guys can check at home, too. That gauge that we've been talking about that's right below the hatchery is on the MI WaterNet system. So that's a Lake State gauge program. It's right there on the East Branch.
Listeners can see not only that gauge, but several others
all over.
Yeah. USGS. Yes. Yeah.
There's some good info out there. That's awesome, guys. This has been really entertaining and educational, yeah. And I do appreciate it. And it's got a nice history aspect to it, because I mean, this, to your point earlier, it's been around for a while. It's been a part of the community for a while, and it's nice to see it in its new iteration.
Yeah. So if we can keep the manpower and turn it into a trout miniature Meyer's garden for trout lovers.
Yeah, there you go.
I mean, that's how's that for a concept?
You know, oops, sorry,
Don. It would be a goal.
Yeah. That would be one good end result. I would like to see more research done. We'll see about that. But even as it is, if we can beautify it and have trout viewing, and then maybe have it as an event location, a high school fly fishing or middle school fly fishing school or something like that. And we've talked about a number of those things. Would be another.
Would the terms and conditions of your charter allow fishing in there in special occasions?
So we do have fishing in the kids' bluegill ponds. There's no more catch and cook your own dinner like folks are kind of used to from years past.
Back in the day.
But if you bring your own tackle, bring your fishing rods, it doesn't need to be a fly fishing rod. It can be conventional gear. It's catch and release in the bluegill ponds in the back half of our property. So that way, getting kids outside, still able to get that first foothold of fishing in their system, while at the same time learning about why, you know, guys like us find enjoyment in catching fish and sending it right back to the river. So,
rubber spider, a kid, and a fly rod, and some bluegills.
There you go.
That's a pretty good day.
And hey, you know, the other thing that's worth mentioning too is the hatchery is a free resource for the public. So we don't charge any admission fee. We're never going to ask or solicit you for money. If you want to feed our fish, it is $2. We do have donation drives set up really to fund different projects that we're going to do throughout the year. We've been making a commitment on doing footbridges so visitors can have a different perspective walking over the raceways, entirely self-funded. Those are Facebook drives. Those are community members sending us checks. It's people coming in and giving us $10 and only taking one bag of fish food that costs $2, you know. It's really stuff like that. When you combine that with the educational aspect, it's a great place to bring your kids, and at the same time as they're having fun, at the same time they're going to be learning something that they're going to be able to put into some practicability years down the road. So,
you know, and that's kind of, to me, the cool thing about our community is that, and the people that visit it as well.
Yeah.
They're very generous,
mm-hmm.
and they do have a passion, and it's neat to see this being continued and growing and offering further opportunities. That's awesome.
You know, whether you like fish, whether you just like nature, there is something for everybody at the hatchery.
Well, you don't have to be an angler.
You absolutely do not need to be an angler. Right. We're going to teach you about bugs and more trout-related facts, and you might become a heck of a fly angler years down the road with a little bit of preference to maybe bamboo and not graphite. But, you know, there's literally something for everybody to come and see at the fish hatchery, and if you just if you just open up your eyes, you let your ears wander, imagination and creativity can take you a long way at the fish hatchery.
That's a wonderful way to put it, Mitch. Excellent. Hey, do you guys have how do you promote yourselves? Website?
Yeah, so you can find the Grayling Fish Hatchery on Facebook, simply as Grayling Fish Hatchery.
We're okay.
Grayling Fish Hatchery on Instagram as well. You can get a hold of myself. I'm the hatchery manager, so whether you want to schedule a group tour, ask any questions,
true.
Send your donations.
I'm assuming you guys do it like we do. Not everybody can get out there on the weekend, and so if you're in town, we have people email us. I'm assuming that's the situation with you.
Yeah. Our email and phone number is located on our Facebook page as well.
Okay.
I'll get you that email here.
Yeah,
it should just be graylingfishhatchery.com.
Shoot me the stuff and we'll put it in the show notes and people can reference it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that's great. Awesome, guys. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And continued success.
Yeah.
I think it's really exciting.
It really is.
You guys did a great job.
Thanks for coming out. This is a good
one. Yeah, this is a good episode. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks
for
having us.
Be well, have fun, and do try to find a way out and, you know, cast a fly on your own.
Yeah. If you need pointers or tips, we may be able to help you out at the fish hatchery.
Yeah, exactly. I think between you guys and the Trout Fishing Museum, we could probably hook up a few people.
Exactly.
Very good.
Hopefully. Yeah.
Thanks, guys.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, there we go, everybody. A couple of great guys doing some great work. Check out their website and their Facebook page for the Grayling Hatchery. Just fantastic. Fantastic. It's good to have people talk about their passion and be excited about it. So until next week, we'll ask that you mind your back cast, and we'll be back with another great episode next week. Thanks, everybody.